Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Alice Bryant. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Africa's mountain gorilla population has been decreasing for many years. But now, wildlife groups say their numbers are finally rising. The mountain gorillas live in protected forest areas in Rwanda, Uganda, and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. But they have faced the danger of disappearing as their population steadily fell. The gorillas' environment has been threatened by human agriculture production in surrounding areas. Other threats include illegal hunting, civil unrest, and human-introduced diseases. The mountain gorilla had been included on an endangered red list published by the International Union for Conservation of Nature, or IUCN. It was listed as critically endangered. On November 14th, the Switzerland-based group changed that listing to endangered. In 2008, the mountain gorilla population was estimated to be around 680. In 2018, IUCN estimates showed the number had increased to more than 1,000. IUCN officials noted the new growth was fueled by increased and improved conservation programs. Several nations had cooperated to create effective conservation efforts, the organization said in a statement. This led to positive engagement from communities living around the mountain gorilla habitat, the statement said. Tara Stoinski is president and chief scientist of the Diane Fossey Gorilla Fund. The not-for-profit group is based in Atlanta, Georgia. It is named after the researcher whose work helped bring international attention to mountain gorillas. The organization has been involved in conservation programs. Stoinski called the IUCN findings a great conservation success. In a statement, she said mountain gorillas have experienced some of the highest levels of protection of any animal in history. This is the type of extreme conservation required if we want to ensure a future for wildlife, she added. The conservation efforts included increased enforcement measures against illegal hunting and emergency health care for injured gorillas, the IUCN said. One not-for-profit group called Gorilla Doctors keeps medical workers in each of the countries where mountain gorillas live. They are called to treat animals with disease or carry out rescues when gorillas are caught in traps set for other animals. The IUCN also announced that populations of the threatened fin whale are also on the rise. The group said bans on commercial whaling in the North Pacific Ocean and elsewhere had helped some of the populations grow. The fin whale appeared on the red list as endangered, but that has been changed to vulnerable. I'm Brian Lynn.
France aims to bring more foreign students to its universities by offering more classes taught in English. French Prime Minister Edouard Philippe announced the plan on Monday. He said increasing the number of foreigners studying in the country would help build French influence overseas. France is home to famous universities like the Sorbonne in Paris, and several leading business schools. The country is a popular choice among non-English-speaking students, but it ranks behind the United States, Britain, and Australia in the total number of foreign students who study there. Between 2011 and 2016, the number of foreign students studying at French universities fell by 8.5%. The country has seen increased competition from Germany, Russia, Canada, and China. Philippe said that in the education field, just as in other economic ones, the world's balance of power is shifting. That's why we need to welcome more foreign students. Under the new plan, France will ease student visa requirements. Student visa applications also will be available online. Starting next March, foreigners who have earned a French master's degree will be able to receive a residence visa. The change is meant to help recent graduates look for work or set up a business in France. France also plans to increase the costs for students who come from outside the European Economic Area. Currently, students in France, including foreign students, pay 170 euros a year for a bachelor's degree and 243 euros a year for a master's degree. Officials said the low cost of education in France leads students from other countries like China to believe that the quality of a French education is lower than what other countries offer. Beginning in September 2019, non-European students will pay 2,770 euros a year for a bachelor's degree and 3,770 euros for graduate degrees. That is still much less costly than some other European countries, however. Prime Minister Philippe said the costs for foreign students will remain well below the 8,000 euros to 13,000 euros charged by the Dutch, or the tens of thousands of pounds paid in Britain. France will use the extra money to build better education facilities and increase the number of scholarships for foreign students.
The verbs let, allow, and permit are part of a group of verbs called causatives. These verbs express how one person or thing causes something else to happen. For instance, if I said, "She let me borrow the book," the subject "she" is not the person who borrowed the book. Instead, she caused someone, me, to borrow it. In a past Everyday Grammar program, we told you about the causative verbs make, get, and have. Today, we will tell you about let, allow, and permit, three verbs that deal with permission. These verbs are synonyms, words with very close meanings. They mean to give permission to someone or something to do something, or to make it possible for someone or something to have or do something. We will look at each verb, but let's begin by talking a little bit more about causatives. In a causative sentence, the subject does not perform the action of the main verb. Instead, the subject, a person or thing, causes the action to happen to the object, another person or thing. Causative sentences start with a subject, followed by a causative verb, then an object, and then the main verb. Think of it as X causing Y to do something. Okay, now let's talk about let. It is the most informal of the three verbs. Listen to some examples and make a note of which sentences are about possibility and which are about permission. You will also hear that the main verbs, go, enjoy, and cook, are in simple form. The simple form is the most basic form of a verb without to before it or s at the end. Have a listen.
I let my children go to the game every week.
The warm days let us enjoy the end of summer.
Let the vegetables cook for about 20 minutes.
Now let's look at allow. It is more formal than let, but less formal than permit. You can use it in everyday situations. You may also find it in official rules, such as street, building, and office signs. With allow, we use the infinitive form for main verbs. The infinitive form is to plus the simple form of the verb. In the following examples, make a note of the meaning of allow in each. Which sentences are about permission? Which are about possibility? And note the use of infinitive main verbs.
My teaching skills allow me to help English learners.
Her parents do not allow her to eat beef.
They do not allow us to smoke in the building.
You may have noted that two examples are in the negative form. When talking about rules, we often use allow in the negative to say what people must not do. Now let's take a quick break to talk about the passive form, an important form for these verbs. The verbs allow and permit are often used in passive sentences. You may remember our past programs on passive voice. In a passive sentence, the subject is acted upon or receives the action of the verb. The subject is often not mentioned in the sentence. When we speak or write about official rules, we often use passive voice. Let's hear the smoking rule again, this time in the passive.
Smoking is not allowed in the building.
The person or people who made the rule are not mentioned because it is not relevant to the statement. Now on to permit, the most formal of the three verbs. We use it for everyday rules, such as those of a family. We also use it when talking about making things possible. But in American English, Permit is more common in sentences about official rules, such as in signs and handbooks, that state what you are not permitted to do. And like allow, we use the infinitive form for main verbs with permit. Listen for the infinitives in these examples.
Her parents do not permit her to eat beef.
The city does not permit pets to ride the metro.
The zoo does not permit visitors to feed the animals.
Again, for official rules, we often use passive voice. Let's hear two of the examples as passive.
Pets are not permitted to ride the metro.
Visitors are not permitted to feed the animals.
Imagine these as public signs. Most public signs are not complete sentences. What you often will see is very short wording, such as smoking not permitted. It is important to note that not all sentences with let, allow, and permit follow the causative sentence structure. Well, I hope you enjoyed letting me tell you about these causative verbs today. I'm Alice Bryant.
Today on The Making of a Nation, we continue the story of the American Revolution. Here is Steve Ember.
On July 4th, 1776, the Second Continental Congress, meeting in Philadelphia, approved the Declaration of Independence. The new country, the United States of America, was at war with its former colonial ruler, Britain. Yet, not everyone in the former colonies agreed with the decision to declare independence. No one knows for sure how many Americans remained loyal to Great Britain. John Adams, the Massachusetts political leader, thought that about a third of the colonists supported independence, a third supported Britain, and a third supported neither side. Today, many historians think that only about 20% of the colonists supported Britain. Some colonists supported whichever side seemed to be winning. As many as 30,000 Americans fought for the British during the war. Others helped Britain by reporting the movements of American troops. Who supported Britain? These groups included people who were appointed to their jobs by the king. They also included leaders of the Anglican Church and people with business connections to the British. Professor Gordon Wood at Brown University in Rhode Island says many colonists from minority groups remained loyal to the king.
One of the problems of the American Revolution that emerged very quickly was the tyranny of the majority, which the founders, the revolutionary leaders, had not anticipated. But I think we're seeing the problems that emerge when you overthrow an authoritarian leader and you're going to have a relatively democratic society, then protecting the minority becomes a problem.
Other people remained loyal because they did not want change or because they believed that independence would not improve their lives. Some thought the actions of the British government were not bad enough to bring about a rebellion. Others did not believe that the rebels could win a war against a nation as powerful as Britain. American Indians disagreed among themselves about the revolution. Congress knew it had to make peace with the Indians as soon as the war started. If not, American troops might have to fight them and the British at the same time. To prevent trouble, American officials tried to stop settlers from moving into Indian lands. In some places, the Indians joined the Americans, but generally they supported the British. They expected the British to win. They saw the war as a chance to force the Americans to leave their lands. At times, the Indians fought on the side of the British, but left when the British seemed to be losing the battle. The Americans did not forget that the Indians chose to fight for the British. When the war was over, the Americans felt they owed the Indians nothing. African slaves in the colonies were also divided about which side to join during the American Revolution. Thousands of slaves fought for the British. The British offered them freedom if they served in the army or navy. Some American states also offered to free slaves who served, and hundreds of free blacks fought on the American side. Many slaves, however, felt their chances for freedom were better with the British. At least 5,000 blacks served with the colonial American forces. Most had no choice. They were slaves, and their owners took them to war or sent them instead of the owner's sons. Other slaves felt that a nation built on freedom might share some of that freedom with them. In the South, many slave owners kept their slaves at home rather than send them to fight. Later in the war, when every man was needed, many slaves drove wagons and carried supplies. Those who served in the colonial army and navy were not separated from whites. They fought side by side with whites during the American Revolution. But historians say most slaves spent the war as they always had, working on their owners' farms. The American rebels called themselves patriots. Those who supported the British were known as Tories. Patriots often seized the property of Tories to help pay for the war. They also kidnapped the slaves of Tories to use as laborers for the army. Many Tories were forced from towns in which they had lived all their lives. Some were tortured or hanged. In New Jersey, Tories and Patriots fought one another with guns and sometimes burned each other's houses and farms. Some historians say the American Revolution was really the nation's first civil war. The Revolution divided many families. Jane Gordon at the Massachusetts Historical Society tells of a woman named Phoebe. Phoebe was married to a patriot, but her brother was a Tory.
And we think about what it must have been like for Phoebe in the middle between her husband and her brother. So that's a perfect example of a family that was split.
The Patriots were also split among themselves in their thinking. The colonies did not really think of themselves as one nation. They saw themselves as independent states, trying to work together toward a common goal. Historian Gordon Wood says, at first, the United States was more like the European Union is today.
When Jefferson said, "My country," he meant Virginia. John Adams said, "My country," he meant Massachusetts.
This meant that Congress could not order the states to do anything they did not want to do. Congress could not demand that the states provide money for the war. It could only ask for their help. George Washington, the top general, could not draft men into the army. He could only wait for the states to send them. Washington showed that he was a good politician by the way he kept Congress and the 13 states supporting him throughout the war. Just as Americans did not all agree about the war, the British people did not agree about it either. Many supported the government's decision to fight. They believed that the war was necessary to rescue loyalists from the Patriots. Others did not think Britain should fight the Americans because the Americans had not invaded or threatened their country. They believed that Britain should leave the colonies alone to do as they wished. King George was not able to do this, however. He supported the war as a way to continue his power in the world and to rescue British honor in the eyes of other national leaders. Whichever side British citizens were on, there was no question that the war was causing severe problems in Britain. British businessmen could no longer trade with the American colonies. Prices increased, taxes did too, and young men were forced to serve in the Royal Navy. At the start of the war, the British believed that the rebellion was led by a few extremists in New England. They thought the other colonies would surrender if that area could be surrounded and controlled. So they planned to separate New England from the other colonies by taking control of the Hudson River Valley. The British changed their plans after they were defeated in the Battle of Saratoga in New York State. Historian Gordon Wood says the British loss changed the nature of the war.
The French feel at this point that the Americans might make it, and therefore they throw in their support. Once the French come on board, then the British are really panicked. At that point, they offer the Americans everything the Americans had wanted, save independence. But it was too late.
The British experienced many problems fighting the war. Their troops were far from home across a wide ocean. It was difficult to bring in more troops and supplies. Gordon Wood says the distance across the Atlantic was one reason the British lost the war.
Even though they were the most powerful nation in the world, had a superb army, and of course completely controlled the seas, and they were dealing with the ragtag army of George Washington and a bunch of militia, and they couldn't do it.
General Washington's army had its own problems, too. Congress never had enough money. States often did not do what they were supposed to do. And citizens were not always willing to fight. Soldiers were poorly trained and would promise to serve for only a year or so.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.